stands about 5'4" from the head to the ground. She comes around here right about midnight. Oh, she makes me feel so good. I wanna say she makes me feel right when nothing else does, and it needs a cheat. Very much.
She can stop the winter with her eyes. The rain wants to wait in the sky. The wind wants to wait till she
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRSCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum. And of course, we have a lot of varied stories for you in the news. Let's start off, first of all, with a story on taxes, since it's the beginning of the tax season. Now, this is not going to be anything new. It's been covered for several years now, but let's get the latest from MSNBC.
Dorothy Brown says she got into tax law because she didn't want to deal with race at work. She's a black woman academic from the South Bronx. She says she faced racism every day of her life. So when it came to choosing a career, she went with math because numbers. I mean, with numbers, there's no way that something that's as straightforward and numerical as the tax system could deal with race, right? Well, Dorothy Brown says, quote, "I've never been so wrong about something in my life." After getting her law degree and then her master's in tax law, Brown was helping her parents with their taxes when she noticed something odd. Now, they were married, but they didn't seem to benefit from the tax breaks that one should expect to see from a married couple. Dorothy Brown dug in and quickly discovered that the IRS does not collect or publish data for race the same way they do for gender or for age. So that caused Brown to begin to dig deeper and deeper. She says she became a detective, looking at the history of different tax laws. She looked at who benefits from most tax breaks and loopholes and who doesn't. Take her parents' marriage examples. Now, marriage tax cuts only benefit single-wage earner households or couples where one worker makes significantly more than the other. So, for example, a household where both spouses work and make similar incomes, they're not going to get the tax cut. And as it turns out, households with equal earners that have two full-time workers, they're more likely to be black. And then, by contrast, household where there is a single-wage earner, where one spouse can afford to stay home and not work, those are significantly more likely to be white. Now, through arduous study and research, Brown uncovered a long list of ways that both tax law and the many other systems that impact wealth generation tend to favor white Americans and also disadvantage black Americans. In her book, The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It, was published in 2021. Since then, Brown has been appointed to the Treasury Advisory Committee on Racial Equity under Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Brown and her other committee co-members have made recommendations on how to address racial equity matters within the tax code. She recently said in an interview with NPR that despite the board's work and recommendations, quote, "We have not seen much progress at all." Joining me now is Dorothy Brown, professor of law at Georgetown University and member on the Advisory Committee on Racial Equity at the Department of the Treasury. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. Dorothy, you said in an interview with NPR's Marketplace recently that you haven't seen a whole lot of interest in just this conversation about centering race and racial equity within the Treasury. Why do you think that is?
Because Treasury doesn't see racial equity as something that they should be focusing on. They haven't historically. They give lip service to it under Secretary Yellen. But when the Treasury Advisory Committee makes recommendations like you should really have a path forward on collecting data by race, because you shouldn't depend on an academic like Dorothy Brown to uncover the racial biases in our tax code. There's a Stanford study that came out last year that showed if you were black and you filed for the earned income tax credit, you were 3 to 5 times more likely to be audited than if you were non-black. That needs to be fleshed out. The Treasury should be at the forefront of this. We made the recommendation in March of last year, and we have seen very little progress. Data is critical. The IRS and Treasury publish a lot of data about a lot of things, but not about race. And I'm very disappointed in Secretary Yellen not moving our recommendations forward faster.
This is such an important conversation because there are so many of us within our community, within Black America, who feel like there are things systemically that hold us back or that are pressing on us in different ways, but we can't prove it. We can't point to it. So when you bring up the notion of data, I just want to underscore how valuable and imperative that is. Dorothy, you're a friend to Velshi and the show, and you spoke to Ali about 3 years ago, and you said that one of the things that was most important there was for the IRS to collect and to publish data on race, the same way they do with age and gender. And President Biden's racial equity order back in 2021, that actually affirmed that. From a policy place, what do you think has to happen in order to bring that into a reality? Is the pressure to be applied in the Treasury? Is it to be applied to legislatures? Is it a combination of both? Or do you think it's in the courts where this needs to be fought?
No, it's very simple. The White House needs to pick up the phone and tell Treasury Secretary Yellen they meant what they said in the racial equity order, and they expect progress on the Treasury Advisory Committee's recommendations forthwith. It's not complicated. We have a path forward. We recommended how to get it done, and the White House needs to step up and say, we meant it. We need disaggregated data by race in the Treasury and IRS. We have it at HUD. We have it at the Department of Labor. We know how many people ride bicycles by race, but we don't know how taxpayers pay their taxes by race. It is a sin and a shame.
I'm glad you brought up those examples of other places in government that are already doing this, because what it does is that it eliminates the argument that, well, we don't ever do this. We never sort of look at these statistics. The fact that there are models that exist across other agencies is so critical for building a model that is consistent across all government agencies. Back in 2020,
I actually call it Treasury's exceptionalism. Mm. They are the outlier here.
Well, that's important to point out, and I'm glad you did. Back in 2020, there were a lot of folks from different communities, a lot of white Americans, for example, who had questions about how to show up, how to be allies. And right now, you've said that it's important for white Americans to engage with the subject of racism and wealth accumulation and racism in the tax system as well. You've mentioned that this sort of allyship is helpful and impactful for white Americans to be forthcoming about in terms of intergenerational wealth and about their experiences with wealth building. This is not done to shame anyone for what they've been able to achieve, but to help illuminate the issues around disparities. Can you talk about how critical this piece of allyship is for people who are invested in building greater equity?
It's very important, because you may be sitting at you're a Black employee, you may be sitting at the cubicle next to your white colleague, and your white colleague is sending their children with the same salary, which is a big assumption based on race in the labor market, but with the same salary, your next door cubicle person can send their kids to private school, lives in a really nice house. And you're like, how come I can't make it work? You, Black employee, if you're a college grad, you're more likely to send money to your parents. Your white peer is more likely to get money from their parents. And if white Americans talk more about this hidden form of wealth, what I call interfamily transfers, mm-hmm. then Black Americans see we're not doing anything wrong. We've got a tax system that we are paying for, but that are stripping us of wealth. We have a Treasury Secretary that doesn't seem to want to move the ball forward. And we have this intergenerational wealth advantage that white Americans have that often don't want to talk about. But I will say, Charles, since my book came out, I've gotten emails from white Americans telling me their story and saying, I want to be an ally. And let me tell you how my whiteness helped me financially.
Dorothy Brown, thank you so much for your important work.
Oh, yes, folks, the media. We love it. We hate it. We hate it. We love it. But then folks just like disappear off the airwaves. Like Royce Jones, who was dismissed from KDKA TV here in Pittsburgh. And the only explanation was a two-sentence statement from the station manager saying, we wish him well in his future endeavors. That's the way it ended. Okay, we talked about Royce. Let's talk about nationally. And let's talk about Tiffany Cross, who has recently come back to the airwaves. Here's another news story for you.
Dear Sister Tiffany Cross speaks out about her MSNBC firing and other stuff. Let's put it up full mass. On her podcast, Native Land Pod, which, by the way, has been getting significant play on Indisputable because they're doing interesting things. Native Land Pod with Angela Rye and Andrew Gillum. Tiffany Cross would share about her time working on MSNBC. So Cross actually first would talk about working with Joe Scarborough. Here it is.
I was invited to appear on Morning Joe. So Joe Scarborough, I'm sure y'all have watched Joe Scarborough before. On the segment right before I was coming on, Joe Scarborough started saying that he wanted the Republican Party to get their act together. He didn't want his country run by some of the leftists who were running countries like Portland. And he called out some other municipalities that this was right after the height of Black Lives Matter. And so he said, we got to get it together. And the Republican Party is failing. Donald Trump, turn the party racist. So when I was introduced, I obviously had a lot to say about that, that there's an unspoken rule that you're not supposed to disagree with Joe, but I didn't get that memo. Even if I had, I don't know how much attention I would pay to it. And so when it came time for me to speak, I went through very specific policies, talked about Ronald Reagan, talked about George Bush, and made the point that even though they may have been more articulate, their policies were just as damaging to Black folks. Well, after I got off the air, he continued to talk about it. He was very upset, apparently. And so when he left set, he was beside himself. That's how it was described to me. I was told from several reputable sources, including a talent agent, two anchors, and another executive at the network, that he left set and went into the president's office, the president of the network, to complain about my segment, complained that I disagreed with him, said that I called him racist, and suggested that I should not be Joy Reid's successor to get the show.
Well, damn. Spill all the tea. I'm here for it. And there's more. She then talked about her battles that she faced while working on her show, The Cross Connection. Here it is.
I want you all to know, every single week, from the start of my show to the very last show I did, it was a battle. Every single week, it was a battle to cover things that I wanted to talk about. The network's philosophy was Trump. They wanted me to be part of the echo chamber, and I fought as hard as I could. When I would fight these battles, I know y'all know exactly what I mean. I was spoken to in the most condescending ways. I mean, anything from being told the definition of news. Me, with my 20 plus year career in news and broadcast and television, I would have somebody sit across from me and explain to me how news worked. I had my intelligence questioned. The central theme to them, again, Trump, Capitol Hill minutia, and they wanted me to use the same recycled faces you see all the time. So I really found the constant criticism debilitating at times, but mostly confusing. And let me tell you why, because viewers seem to love it. According to NBC's own research department, The Cross Connection, my show, was averaging 4.6 million viewers a month. We had the most Black viewers, second only to Reverend Al Sharpton's show. We were routinely the highest rated show of the entire weekend. In fighting these battles, I can't lie, I made some enemies. I held the line. I didn't acquiesce because, for me, what was the point in having this platform if I'm going to show up and spit out some vanilla granola boringness and hope that one day maybe the white man will let me host his Today Show? I've just never seen that happen. I have never seen anybody be rewarded for acquiescing to the comfort of white folks.
Such an amazing talent, an amazing soul. Here's her talking about being let go.
But one night, Tucker Carlson dedicated the top of his show to me. After this, the network did not issue a statement the way they had for some of my white colleagues who had also been targeted by MAGA extremists. Instead, network executives spoke to me and instructed me that I could not respond to Tucker Carlson at all. Then they began to scrutinize my show. Every little thing I wrote, every little thing I said before the show, after the show. After the show, it was always, here's all the things that you said. Here's all the things that you did wrong. The ratings didn't lie, but according to them, people must just be tuning in to criticize me because that's all they had was criticism. Never thanks for doing a good job. Never thanks for bringing so many new viewers to the network. This was 4 days before midterms and 1 day before my show was going to air. We had booked an exclusive sit down with Stacey Abrams, who, as you all know, was in the fight for her life running for governor at that time. That morning, I got a call from the president of the network saying they would not be renewing my contract, which was up in a month, and that my viewers would not even be given the courtesy or respect of me being able to sign off or have a final show. I think it's important that you all know when that happens, it suggests to other people in the industry that this person is so unhireable that we could not trust her with a live mic. And I was never given an official reason for why they canceled my show, but it was pretty obvious that I had drawn the ire of white conservatives, which even made some white liberals uncomfortable. So I had to go. Never mind that millions of people found my voice to reflect theirs. Despite me not saying anything at the time, other than to issue a very politely worded and gracious statement, mostly for my viewers, a statement in which did not attack the network at all or say anything bad about them, the network began attacking me. They planted hit pieces in the press. The president of the network began a bizarre, unhinged tour where she was on damage control. I don't know what she was trying to do, but it was filled with outright lies, including showing up on the set of The View. It's very strange for the president of a competing network to show up at another network and talk directly to their talent. That just doesn't happen.
It's a damn shame she had to go through that. Obviously, she is not the only one who has echoed the sentiment that you just heard. Very proud of her elevation and her honesty. The transparency not only provides therapy for the individual, but also for us, understanding that common reality that many face. I want to take a moment to say thank you to somebody in my early career, because I never realized how powerful that moment was back then. There's a guy named Steve Doerr. Steve was an executive for the local CBS News Atlanta station. It was the first time I was on television years ago. And I was brought on as their political analyst. And I remember saying to Steve something to the effect of, I may not be the brand you all are looking for because I'm a strong cup of coffee for the news. And Steve looked at me and he said, just be who you are. And that moment was a powerful moment. I was going to be me no matter what, but knowing that he was endorsing that, I never knew how rare it was. That was years ago. And the stories I hear today that are so antithetical to the promotion of truth, everything is measured and manipulated and sanitized. We're supposed to be in an industry that cares about the authenticity of debate, the reality of cause and effect. If somebody takes a hit at one of ours, damn it, we take a hit back at them. Way to go. All right, David, thoughts here.
Well, full disclosure, I worked at MSNBC for 8 years. I was fired in 2010, and there's a whole set of circumstances. But what I first of all, I want to salute Tiffany for her courage in speaking out, because it takes a lot of guts to do this. What's so sad about, to me, and hearing what Tiffany said, is Tiffany lost her show. She was fired in 2022. That was a different MSNBC president than the one that I had to deal with in some of the same sort of issues. So I'm saddened to hear that the relatively new regime at MSNBC is perpetuating some of the same problems, some of the same snake pit tactics, going to the media, leaking things about you, not circling the wagons and defending you against other talent, but instead being more concerned about, oh, well, we need to pound this nail into the sand because we don't want anybody to stick out. I am so saddened to hear that that still exists at MSNBC. And I think it's a reason why I think a lot of progressives intuitively and instinctively know that even though MSNBC is supposedly representing a more progressive or liberal counterpoint to, say, Fox News and maybe even CNN, there's still a certain amount of corporatism and white privilege that exists even at MSNBC. It is still part of that corporate system where certain people are not going to get a fair shake, no matter what MSNBC claims to stand for. And I salute Tiffany for pulling back the curtain on this, as ugly as it may be.
Yeah, very well said. And man, they missed a great opportunity for contrast. Tucker is an idiot. And Tiffany was right on the commentary. And so I can't believe they allowed that to steamroll anything. Hell of a thing.
Yes, it is a hell of a thing when this happens. And unfortunately, it continues on at all levels of the media. We look at the departure of Royce Jones at KDKA several months ago, and he was let go without absolutely no explanation. He didn't really go into an explanation either why he left, but watching him, I knew he was an excellent broadcaster and gatherer of news there at that station. Yeah, we still go through this stuff. As we continue on, we look at more things in the news today. And of course, we got to talk about Mr. T. You know who I'm talking about. And it ain't the A-team, Mr. T.
What does MAGA mean to you then? So Make America Great Again, what does that mean to you?
The America I grew up with, we want it back. We want people to stop censoring us. We want them to stay away from our Second Amendment. We want freedom of religion. So if you're conservative, if you're a Christian, if you're white, you're male, it doesn't matter what color you are. We want people to be respected for who they are. We don't need to have infinity stones because you're black, you're gay, you're trans. We just want everybody to be treated equal. And they're trying to say that we're the party of the racist party when they're the ones actually wanting Jim Crow rules back.
In what way?
Well, way, colleges. They want to have black and white graduations. They want to separate us.
Where do they want that?
What colleges? Man, look. Okay, I don't know. Google it.
Make America Great Again. What does that mean to you? What's the again?
To me, the again means that we have somewhere safe where we can have those freedoms that we are so lucky to enjoy. There are so many people throughout the world that do not have what we have, and it is a blessing. That's why we have people that want to be here, and we will fully encompass all of that greatness again.
When did we last have it, if it's again?
I feel like we did have that when President Trump was in office. I feel like we can work with what he built on in the first presidency and make it even better.
When he was running in 2016, it was before he'd even been president, but he was still saying, make it great again. Again from when?
That is a good question. I would say if I could guess, it would be, and I think that they're very politically lined up, would be maybe with JFK. And when he was president and what we embodied with some optimism and freedoms that we didn't have before and trying to find that.
When was America last great?
4 years ago, or 3 years ago.
Well, he was saying it before he got there. He was saying, make it great again. So he didn't think, what did that message mean to you then?
I felt President Reagan was an excellent president too.
And nobody between Reagan and Trump.
I am not a Democrat, so.
Well, you had George Bush there, and you had George Bush's son.
He was, right, yeah, but I still liked President Reagan.
Make America great again. It's been his mantra since he's run in 2015. What does that mean? What is again? When was America great?
Well, that question right there says everything that I need to know about you, that you don't really think America was ever great at any time. I think America was great. The spirit, the whole purpose for America was about the American spirit, coming here and making something for yourself and having the opportunity to do that for yourself, to work hard. And that's what America is all about. So the people that hate America will always say, well, when was it ever great? It's just not a very good attitude to have, in my opinion.
I mean, when was that lost in your estimation?
I think a lot of it was lost when the Federal Reserve took over the money system. We need to go back to a gold and silver-backed system where currency is it counts.
What does Make America Great Again mean to you?
It means stopping the invasion of our nation by illegal immigration. It means rebuilding our economy that's been destroyed by the Biden administration. And it means making us secure in the world again through our strength in the world that keeps the whole world in check.
What does that mean to you, the again part of that? When was it great to you?
Supposed to have been great in the founding era. Then it got changed in the middle 1800s, and I won't go into all the details because that's too long of a story.
But that was slavery in the Civil War.
It's a little different than that because in the late 1800s, the manipulators bought out all the school publishers, and so they changed the narratives.
And so that's when America was great then, around that time?
It's supposed to have been great up until, well, maybe up to the time of Andrew Jackson.
And when was it great in your lifetime?
Unfortunately, the cognitive dissonance is such that it actually never really was. I went through fear porn, Vietnam War, you know, duck and cover drills for the, you know, nuclear stuff. So I've never experienced it being really great.
Even when Trump was president?
Even when Trump was president, he was doing a lot to bring it back. I'm grateful when he got inflation down.
Original Trump critic turned Trump sycophant, perhaps the most squirrely of them all, is Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Back in 2015, Senator Graham was running against Donald Trump for the Republican nomination, and he was about as critical as it gets.
I think he's a kook. I think he's crazy. I think he's unfit for office. He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot.
He's a jack.
You know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
Then after he lost the primary and Donald Trump became president, Graham did a complete 180. He wanted so badly to be close to the man in power, and he was willing to humiliate himself to get there. In October of Trump's first year in office, Senator Graham tweeted about a round of golf he played with the president, quote, "President Trump shot a 73 in windy and wet conditions. How bad did he beat me? I did better in the presidential race than today on the golf course!" Exclamation point. The slobbering continued up until January 6th when Senator Graham claimed he finally had enough.
Trump and I, we've had a hell of a journey. I hate it to end this way. Oh, my God, I hate it. From my point of view, he's been a consequential president. But today, first thing you'll see, all I can say is count me out. Enough is enough. I've tried to be helpful.
By the way, consequential is funny. Now, that didn't last long. Soon enough, Lindsey Graham was right back at it, tearing up on Fox News as he literally begged viewers to send Donald Trump money.
"I'm sorry I'm so upset, but please help President Trump. If you can afford $5 or $10, if you can't afford a dollar, fine. Just pray. Make sure you vote as early as you can in your state. Don't risk anything anymore. Vote as soon as you can. Pray for this country. Pray for this president. And if you got any money to give, give it."
Bro, come on. Now, 9 years into this routine, Lindsey Graham has flip-flopped once again. According to wild new reporting, Graham turned on a dime and, quote, threw Trump under the bus during his grand jury testimony in Fulton County, Georgia. Trump faces 13 charges in that state in connection with his efforts to steal the 2020 election. Quote, Graham testified that if you told Trump that Martians came and stole the election, he'd probably believe you. He also suggested to the grand jurors that Trump cheated at golf. It got even weirder from there. After Graham was finished testifying, he bumped into District Attorney Fani Willis in a hallway and thanked her for the opportunity to tell his story. "That was so cathartic," he told Willis. "I feel so much better." Then, to the astonishment of one source who witnessed the scene, South Carolina's senior senator hugged the Fulton County DA. According to one witness, Willis was like, "Whatever, dude." All of those crazy revelations come from a new book by journalists Michael Isikoff and Daniel Kladman titled Find Me the Votes, A Hard-Charging Georgia Prosecutor, a Rogue President, and the Plot to Steal an American Election.
I know that's enough to make me go say, woof. Oh, my goodness. Here's Lene. She's been away, but here she is for you. A little bit longer this week.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black.
but this one could not possibly be brief. I'm sorry. Now, I really wish I was coming back to y'all under better circumstances, but here we are, 4 months into bombs raining on Gaza. Companies and countries conducting business as usual, waiting to see if we care enough to stop sourcing conflict minerals in the Congo. Black kids still getting expelled for their locks over here. Lawmakers literally overriding and vetoing gender-affirming care, and it's an election year. My God, today. And before I say anything, I know many of y'all are looking to me to have all the answers, but we're gonna have to figure this one out together. Now, I met y'all during an election year. And in that year, 2020, after seeing so many Black people killed due to state and police violence, the primary concern for many of us was to pull the rug from underneath all the newly enfranchised racist civilians and policemen who believed being a white man killing a Black person was a recipe for getting away with murder. At that time, Donald Trump had ushered in yet another era in our history of white backlash in response to Black progression. So at the time, Joe Biden was our way out. Unfortunately for us, this late in the game, the Biden administration threw away any chance of maintaining their already disconnected and discontented voter base by aligning itself with genocide, leaving the American people in tumult without enough time to rally behind another candidate with certainty, and it's almost as if it were on purpose. So it would be irresponsible of me to tell you to vote for them at this time, so I won't. I'm gonna just tell you what the landscape is giving. As far as our Democrats, we have Dean Phillips. He's a 55-year-old three-term congressman from Minnesota. He's positioned himself as a younger alternative to Joe Biden on the ticket in hopes of ushering in a new generation of government. He is also the previous co-owner of Talenti Gelato, which means the man knows ice cream, and he also knows business. So economically, he's in favor of policies that are both pro-worker and pro-business. He's also pro-universal health care, does not believe that the government, especially men, should have a say on women's reproductive rights. Hello, praise God, since. However, he's lost the New Hampshire primaries. So if you're interested in my boy, do some research and give him some love in your city. Next up, Marianne Williamson. Y'all seen Coach Carter, Akilah and the Bee? She the one who wrote, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate, but our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure." She is also for universal health care with an emphasis on preventative care and anti-competitive pricing. Stands with the girls on reproductive justice, women's rights, and making climate change correction a top priority. Thank God. Shorty is also into alleviating poverty, creating jobs, and increasing overall prosperity. But she also ran back in 2020, and you should be reminded that she is not a politician by trade, which could maybe be a good thing, but she also has three unsuccessful campaigns under her belt. On the other side of the aisle, who cares? Donald Trump going to jail, but he's also going on the ballot. Ron DeSantis dropped out, but who knows if he's going to pop back on the ballot as a running mate. What you do need to know is that regardless of whoever is going to be on the ticket, the Republican Party has been planning Project 2025 since 2022. Project 2025 is formerly known as a presidential transition project. This is a plan for conservatives to take over what they call the deep state so they can push our government into practicing a unitary executive theory of government, which means instead of checks and balances, the president would have absolute power. Y'all, they got a book and they call it a mandate. They have a 180-day playbook starting January 1st of 2025 in each federal agency. This is why you hear people saying you may never get to vote again. Not just because Donald Trump said he was going to be a dictator from day one. They got a training program, y'all. It's all on Google and it's not a secret. Seems to me like it should be illegal, but the right and the left keep showing us that shit that should be considered illegal is getting done in broad daylight every day. And this isn't me trying to fearmonger you into voting for the Democratic Party. This is me letting you know that these motherfuckers are prepared, making sure that you are informed that January 6th was just practice. They are openly planning a coup from the inside. Over 90 organizations support this, including ALEC, not surprised, the Frederick Douglass Foundation, what? And something called Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. They're already letting you know what type of time they're on. So I'm sure you want to know what other options you have outside of these two. So here are some leading third-party candidates. Now, it would also be irresponsible of me if I didn't say that honestly and realistically, the chances of a third-party candidate winning are extremely low, but only because we waited so long. And that is partly our fault. We were so stressed about the last election and how the Democrats would allow us to escape tyranny that when the election was over, we were too busy making sure the sitting president did what he said he was going to do. Too busy to start planning for a third-party candidate to disrupt the wave, at least not collectively, or out loud for that matter. And while a lot of us may fully agree with third-party platforms statistically, a third-party vote can become a throwaway vote because it takes away votes from the two clear frontrunners, leaving more of a chance for either one of those to win. And unless we actually grind with a third-party candidate at least 4 years, eight would be better for the country to get to know and trust them. Voting for them becomes more of a theoretical act of resistance that could actually bite us in the ass. Still, in this climate, we are clamoring for somebody stable, somebody younger, somebody who cares about our rights and the rights of marginalized people across the globe. So only time will tell whether or not these candidates are a viable option for us this time. We've got Robert F. Kennedy. Yes. Those Kennedys. He's anti-war, believes government should be in service to the people, wants to increase wealth, has really great views on prison reform, community repair, housing, and racial equity, but he's also anti-vax and a secret right-winger. So we've got Jill Stein, a Green Party candidate and environmental activist, and she keeps on running, so let's pay attention to my girl to hear more about what she got to say. Then we've got Cornel West, progressive activist and scholar who's saying all the right things. He wants to abolish poverty and homelessness, to end the iron grip of the ruling class and ensure democracy, and he wants to ban stock trading from government officials. Hey, but word is he can also be a little bit zealous. So we got to keep an eye on him as well. All of this is to say, we as a people have to start moving different if we want different results. At the close of last year, we saw the world upended in a way that it never has been before. This election is important, sure, but we are split as a country in more ways than one, and we can't keep allowing a two-party system to put us in like this one. There are a few ways we can do that. Boycotting, divestment, and striking, but only in concerted, unified, and organized efforts. Look at Starbucks. One demand for their union to pull a tweet in support of Palestine cost them $11 billion in market value, not in profits. And just last week, NASDAQ projected double-digit growth for Starbucks in Q1 because the boycott doesn't seem to be widespread enough. Where's Bayard Rustin when you need him? The civil rights era really needs to be studied for far more than good stories and good men. Hello? They were successful because the people involved had converged interests based on race, class, geographical area, and a common oppressor. And they were also primarily the ones using the bus system, meaning that they were the ones that were keeping the lights on. Now, there are a lot of issues that we can converge on right now. So my question to you is, what lights do we as a people keep on together, and how can we turn them off? Allyship is being called into question here, and exactly how many people care enough to become politically involved? Because regardless of who's in the office next, they can't do anything without our ignorance. So how do we become informed? And how do we engage in a way that doesn't put our bodies on the line? They done showed us time and time again they don't care nothing about our protests, but they will think twice, maybe three times, about them ducats. That's it and that's all.
The Israeli military says it's killed three Palestinians in an undercover operation at the Imam Sinai Hospital in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Reports say Israeli forces disguised as medical staff and Palestinian women killed members of an armed cell hiding inside. The Israeli military sources said the men were planning an imminent attack, identifying one of them as Mohammed Jalamneh. He is reportedly being receiving treatment following a drone strike. The Palestinian Authority confirmed that three people were killed at the hospital by Israeli forces. Hamas denies Israeli assertions that it uses hospitals to hide fighters. Let's bring in our Middle East correspondent, Mark Lewin.
CCTV footage shows Israeli armed forces going into the hospital, many of them disguised as Palestinians, some of them in women's clothes, some of them dressed as medics, and they shot dead three people who they call Hamas terrorists inside this hospital. Now, in fact, Hamas has claimed one of them as their own, and Islamic Jihad, which is a spin-off of Hamas, has identified two other of the victims as members of that organization. Israel says that one of them was planning an attack similar to the 7th of October attack on Israel, of course, and two others were... Sorry, it's incredibly windy now. Two others, they say, that were responsible for a previous attack. Now, this is a sign of just how the violence in the West Bank has continued to spiral since the Gaza conflict began. In fact, the violence in the West Bank is really now the worst that it has been since the second Palestinian Intifada or uprising some two decades ago. And that is a real concern that Gaza's conflict has spilt over into the wider region. And that actually, in order to try to calm what is happening in Gaza, there is also an urgent need to calm what is happening in the West Bank, where violence by Jewish settlers there and violence by armed Palestinian groups on the settlers has reached a level that has not been seen in many, many years.
Well, let's talk more about the wider developments in the Middle East. The US media reporting that the drone which killed three American troops in Jordan on Sunday appears to have been made in Iran, a Shahed attack drone. Tehran has denied involvement, but the US has vowed to retaliate. Let's take you live now to Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stinson Center in Washington and a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. It's always good to have you with us. Washington, the White House, considering its response now to this attack. We keep hearing about this menu of options that they have, and pressure is really growing on President Biden by some Republicans to have quite a firm military response. What do you think the best course is now for President Biden and the White House?
Well, you've referred to the tragic death of three Americans that were hit by an Iranian drone. Look, the best course is to bring down the level of fighting in Gaza. I would add the West Bank, too, in light of recent developments. I mean, I think we have to go to the source of the tensions, which have grown enormously between the United States and these various Iran-backed groups all around the Middle East.
Barbara, sorry to interrupt you, but on that, does it feel to you as if these links, though, are being downplayed by some at the moment? Antony Blinken, for instance, trying to separate what is happening in Gaza with the situation with Iran?
Well, the administration may be trying to separate them, but they're not separable. You know, all of this violence became supercharged after the Israeli retaliation for Hamas's attacks of October 7th. you know, became so massive. We've seen, what, over 26,000 people killed in Gaza since October 7th. And even if you assume that, you know, 9,000-10,000 of them were actually Hamas fighters, that's still an extraordinary civilian death toll, and the destruction has been immense. And so all these various groups around the Middle East that are trying to show their solidarity with the Palestinians, what do? They look for vulnerable targets, and we have small American contingents in Syria, in Iraq, in Jordan, which are unfortunately very vulnerable to these kinds of drone strikes. Now, in this particular case, it appears that the drone could have been shot down, but it was mistaken for an American drone, which was returning to base. And so it got through and it hit an American barracks, and it killed these American reservists from the state of Georgia.
So Barbara, what are the best options now? Because we keep hearing that the response from Washington has to be proportionate. It can't really escalate things, ideally, but also, because of political pressure, has to be some kind of effective deterrent. That's quite difficult for any response to be all of those things.
It's very difficult. And let me point out that the U.S. has already retaliated for previous strikes. It killed the leader of one of these groups in Baghdad earlier in January. So, you know, there's all this talk about assassinations and attacking Iranian oil facilities and Lord knows what. But the best course is to de-escalate the tensions overall by ending the fighting in Gaza. And there are talks that have been going on, mediated primarily by Qatar, to get a long ceasefire in Gaza that would allow hostages there to be released, Palestinian prisoners to be released, and urgently needed humanitarian aid to go into Gaza. That's the best course. What will the U.S. probably do? It will probably hit some of these Iran-backed militia groups, Iraqi groups, groups in Syria that are deemed responsible for the drone strike that killed these three Americans.
Barbara, can I ask you about those talks that you refer to that are taking place in Paris at the moment? Because over the past few days, there's been various comments made from delegates at the talks that are cautiously optimistic of some kind of deal being struck. How can that optimism exist, though, when Benjamin Netanyahu has coalition partners, his right-wing coalition partners in government at the moment, that will refuse to back any kind of ceasefire?
Well, the decision will be made by the Security Cabinet, which excludes some of these right-wing lunatics in Bibi Netanyahu's cabinet. And the deal that's being talked about would be at least for 6 weeks, would allow the release of remaining women and children in Hamas custody, as well as, of course, some Palestinian prisoners. But I think, judging from the comments I'm hearing from the Qataris and others, these talks are well advanced. And I hope, and I think this is one of the considerations for the Biden administration, that any retaliation for what happened to the American troops would not get in the way of securing this long-term ceasefire. This is, I think, the main priority, and I really do hope that the Biden administration is redoubling efforts to get this ceasefire.
And in our last story for this week, we will take a peek at what happened in Los Angeles at the end of last week as far as the L.A. police and Black Lives Matter. Roland Martin is reporting from his program.
Folks, last week, officers with the Los Angeles Police Department conducted a raid on the home of attorney Dermot Gibbons. He is the attorney for Black Lives Matter movement activist Malina Abdullah. She has filed, of course, a lawsuit against the police department. She's suing them for a 2020 incident where she was forced out of her home at gunpoint after receiving a hoax call about a hostage situation. Now, during this search, attorney Gibbons saw an officer photographing documents that were left on his kitchen table that were related to the lawsuit. Well, a judge has ordered the LAPD to get rid of the photographs of legal documents that officers allegedly took during the unannounced raid. Joining us right now on Roland Martin Unfiltered is Malina Abdullah and attorney Dermot Gibbons. Glad to have both of you here. So, attorney Gibbons, I want to start with you. First of all, why was your home being searched?
That's the mystery we want to get to. They said it didn't have anything to do with me. They allegedly were searching for somebody who stole something, and they were tracking an Apple AirTag that they said was in my home. None of this. They didn't give me a copy of the warrant.
Hold on. They said they were searching for a person.
Yes.
And they had the Apple AirTag of said person.
No. That's what I asked them. No, they didn't. Well, they can lie, but they told me when I asked, I asked the same questions you would ask. I didn't get an answer.
So, okay. So, did they have a search warrant?
Yes.
Did they give it to you?
They gave me a couple pages of it, not the important part. No, so the answer
is no.
I'm
sorry, you're an attorney. I'm sure you've seen a search warrant before. Yeah. So yeah. What did they leave out?
The declaration of what the police said to the judge as to why the judge would sign off on the warrant. That's the lie that we need to find out. What did they say?
So that wasn't a part of what they handed you?
No.
All right. So if they were allegedly looking for a person, did they articulate to you why they were looking for that person? And they said that person stole something? Like what?
I don't know. But they showed me the picture of the person, which I assume was in the warrant, but that's not in the part that they left with me. So I can't show that to you.
So they showed you a picture of the person. Was it a man or a woman they was allegedly looking for?
A young man.
Okay. So if you're looking for a person, why are you photographing things? If you're looking for a person, I would think you are opening doors, going into rooms, looking under the bed for a grown person.
I would assume so, too.
Melina, first of all of this sounds very strange, extremely fishy, especially the part of them photographing items on the table that, just happened to be related to your lawsuit against the LAPD.
Yes, it's beyond strange. It's beyond strange. I don't think it could possibly be coincidental that the attorney who's representing me in an LAPD case for them swatting me was essentially swatted himself, and the information that they collected included photos of my case file. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that it's beyond the realm of coincidence that it's unimaginable that it would be coincidental. And I think it shows how corrupt LAPD can be, that they swatted the attorney who is suing them on my behalf for swatting me.
This is kind of basic, Attorney Givens, and they would do it to an attorney as if you're not smart enough to understand what's going on here.
You never underestimate the stupidity of the police. Let me just say that. As I sit here right now, I can surmise and speculate as to what happened, but as you said, pointed out, getting that declaration of what the police said to this judge, because I hope the judge wasn't that stupid, which can happen, because they rubber stamp anything, but there has to be something in that declaration that's the big lie that connected me, my house, to whatever they were doing, which we don't know.
And you lived in your house for 20 years, right?
Over 20 years. They know where I live. That's no. I've sued them. Had major cases against them before. For the LAPD to say they don't know, it's like, you know, like Dr. Abdullah, they know where she lives. You know, and to get a warrant,
and then they sent a First of all, explain to people how that works in order to obtain a warrant.
A police officer has to write down in a declaration and articulate facts that he knows a crime has occurred and whatever the warrant is for, that this warrant will lead to evidence to solve that crime. Then they have to take that to a judge, which a judge then has to find probable cause that, yes, what this officer said is true and is probable cause that a crime has been committed and the person or place that they need to search is most probably involved in that crime. Then the judge signs off on a warrant. Then the police can then go execute the warrant. Obviously, as a friend of mine told me, I'm not involved. Otherwise, I would have been arrested. My house wasn't involved. Otherwise, they would have taken evidence out of my house. The only thing they took out of my house were the pictures of Dr. Abdullah's case.
And so if you're looking for a person, why are you ransacking a house? Why are you literally emptying drawers, opening your safe, and going through your briefcase? What was the person hiding in your briefcase?
I couldn't tell how large the person was. All they showed me was a picture. I don't know.
So
that's what we want to ask them.
A spokesman for the police department. They gave a statement to the either the Associated Press or LA Times. Give me one second. Here it is. I love this. So this is an open criminal investigation as well as an internal affairs investigation, according to Captain Kelly Muniz, spokesman for the LAPD. A criminal investigation?
I have no clue. I have no answers.
What's your next step? Do you have to file something? Can you demand, clearly if they search your house, they have to actually supply you with the actual search warrant. It's been 2 or 3 days and they still haven't done that. They have not given you the full search warrant.
No. And that's what we did on Friday. We went to a judge.
Right.
And that's when the judge ordered them to give it back. So we'll give them a few days and then we'll, you know, hopefully they'll turn it over.
And if not, I mean, would you have to sue them to get it?
No. No, they're under a court order right now to turn it over. Other than that, they'll be be in contempt of court with the court. And they can be sanctioned.
So when you went to court on Friday and the judge ordered the documents to be destroyed, first of all, did the judge give a process to do so other than, hey, Scout's honor, we destroyed them?
No, and you're misstating. They're supposed to turn it over, destroy it, and also give me a copy so I can see what the photos were. So not just destroy it, but also give me a copy of it. The judge, because this is so basic, the judge didn't have to say, go to the police officer who took the pictures and get the camera and get the copies of the, I mean, it's that basic. But what the city attorney is going to do, obviously there's going to be a lot of cover up in this internal affairs investigation or whatever. And they're going to stonewall or whatever, but eventually we'll get it.
Melina,
that's going to say more for Dr. Melina's case. if they don't give it to us.
Right. And that was the point I was about to make. Melina, it's clear that LAPD, first of all, a dozen cops roll up on your attorney's home. Oh, there's a GPS tracker, and we're looking for a Tyler. I mean, come on.
Right. And for them to photograph my case file, right, the damage is done, in my view. If they photographed the case file, they've read the case file. That information, they already have the information in the lawsuit against them. It's already tainted. I don't really know how we can make this right. We know the history of policing in LA County. We know that LA County sheriffs refused to destroy photos after the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash, right? That this is something that they do with regularity, is take photos of things that they shouldn't have and then keep them. So I'm sure that they're going to be using it in their side of the case. And I don't know what we could do. How do you prove that something doesn't exist?
Wow.
But also in that...
incredible. Well,
Roland, let me say this. Dr. Molina's case is so cut and dry and so strong that they can do whatever they want. We're going to get them.
Thank you. I believe you.
Well, certainly keep us abreast of what happens next. This is certainly unbelievable. I take it, obviously, y'all have reached out to the police chief and the mayor demanding answers to all of this, correct?
Me personally, no, because I wouldn't believe a word they would say to me, because before they did this investigation, they should have reached out to me and say, hey, Mr. Gibbons, something's in your house. Can we come? You know, but the communication right now is going to be through the court.
The mayor's been informed, are in a situation where the police chief is retiring at the end of the month. So it's very convenient timing for accountability, right? There's no
accountability.
It's on his way out anyway.
All right, then. Dermot, Melina, we appreciate y'all joining us. Keep us abreast of what happens next.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Georgia seek recognition?
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to speak out of order.
You're recognized.
Mr. Speaker, this past weekend, Georgia tragically lost three of our soldiers in an attack on our military in Jordan. Two were from the 1st District of Georgia. All three were Army reservists assigned to the 718th Engineer Company, 926th Engineer Battalion, 926th Engineer Brigade in Fort Moore, Georgia. Brianna Alexandria Moffitt was 23 years old. She was a native of Savannah. She went to Windsor Forest High School, where she was a member of the Mighty Marching Knights Drum Majors. Kennedy Landon Sanders was 24 years old and from Waycross. Flags are at half staff in Waycross and Ware counties in honor of Sanders. Both women were supporting Operation Inherent Resolve during this Jordan deployment. At this time, I'm going to yield to Representative Drew Ferguson to tell about the third.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to pay tribute to one of my constituents, Sergeant William Jerome Rivers of Carrollton, Georgia. Originally from New Jersey, he enlisted in the Army Reserves in 2011 and moved to the great state of Georgia in 2015, and he loved the great state of Georgia. He had completed a rotation in Iraq in support of Operation Inherent Resolve, was highly decorated. He was a good friend, hard worker, and very dedicated. Today we rise to recognize that his sacrifice will never be forgotten, and we rise to say that our deepest prayers and sympathies are with his beloved wife, Darlene, and his son, William Jr. May we continue to support the lives of our service members.
Mr. Speaker, our brave service members put their lives on the line every day, and we owe our freedoms and security to them. I ask my colleagues representing the state of Georgia and all those here to join me in a moment of silence in honor of our brave heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote our entire show to a new book called The Trillion Dollar Silencer by Joan Roelofs.
Learn about the ways in which our military-industrial complex pervades all aspects of our lives.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
As the notion of perpetual war and a militarized society are normalized, notably absent are anti-war protests by faith-based organizations, civil rights groups, academics, and others. A new book, The Trillion-Dollar Silencer, details this absence while laying bare the devastation wrought in the United States and abroad by the military-industrial complex. Author Joan Roelofs delves into the pervasive role of military contractors and bases that have come to be economic hubs of their regions. She discusses how state and local governments are intertwined with the Department of Defense, including economic development commissions at all levels. Contracts and grants to universities, colleges, and faculty come from the Department of Defense and its agencies, such as the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The Minerva Institute funds social scientists for military research. Civilian jobs in the DoD provide opportunities for scientists, engineers, policy analysts, and others. The Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC, programs are subsidized also by the DoD. In addition to businesses large and small, nonprofits receive DoD contracts and grants, including environmental and charitable organizations such as the Nature Conservancy and Goodwill Industries. Individuals, arts institutions, charities, churches, and universities share in the profitability of military-related investments. Pension funds for public and private employees and unions are replete with military stocks. In other words, the military-industrial complex is so embedded in our political economy that it has become virtually impossible to find any sector of our society that is not intertwined with militarism. Joining us today is Joan Roelofs, Professor Emerita of Political Science at Keene State College. She teaches in the Cheshire Academy for Lifelong Learning and writes for scholarly and political publications. Joan is the author of Foundations and Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, and Greening Cities, Building Just and Sustainable Communities. She has been an anti-war activist ever since she protested the Korean War. Joan, welcome to Law and Disorder, and congratulations on this comprehensive and important book.
Thank you.
Joan, how did you come to be interested in the topic of militarization, and how do you define that?
Well, first I will define militarism. This is the idea that military solutions to many conflicts are the best, are proper, and are effective. Militarization is the penetration of military values, processes, and institutions into civilian life, as well as their expansion into the national budget. I was always opposed to war. One of my major research areas is the political power of the nonprofit sector. So I started researching its connection to militarization.
If you could, Joan, how can you explain to us how did World Wars I and II and the Cold War contribute to the militarization of the United States?
Okay. Militarism was always the dominant culture of this country. But a counterculture of pacifism existed and once was respectable. Enlightenment thought and radical Christianity, as for example in the 19th century communitarian societies, were strongly pacifist. Until 1914, anti-war theologians, artists and writers, and even politicians and business people were held in high esteem by the general population. Social